everyone. We are going to start today with a public hearing on House Bill 2569. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2569 would exempt law enforcement officials acting in the course of official duty from motor vehicle accident reporting requirements. It does declare an emergency. Essentially, what happened was very recently, the Department of Motor Vehicles had asked the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office, whether or not or what course they should take if an officer who gets involved in what's commonly referred to as PITS, pursuit intervention techniques, or other types of uses of their vehicle to stop a fleeing suspect, what duties that law enforcement officer had in those situations. And the Department of Justice determined that they did have a duty under the law to report the accident, and a failure to report the accident would or should result in the officer's driver's license being suspended. There is a -A2 amendment for this committee to consider. It just clarifies a little bit more when the officer need not fill out the accident report.
Thank you. We have Brian Delashmit, Pete Shepard, and Mardell Ployer signed up for this. I thought for sure we were going to get some uniforms up here, but I guess I was on the wrong.
They're at the window dressing. They're sitting right behind us. They'll stand up at the appropriate time.
I see. Are they here on this bill? Okay. I was just going to invite the uniforms up, but that's okay.
Madam Chair, I am wearing my Department of Justice issue blue blazer.
Well, that doesn't count. So, but nice try. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'll start out very briefly. Brian Delashmit, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. This issue came to our attention just prior to the session. There was a kind of an informal work group that's been a little more formal working during the session. I've just seen the A2 amendments now. We strongly recommend not only the passage of the bill, but if Mr. Shepard says the A2 is what we need to incorporate, then I'll go with that. But Council has outlined what the issue is. There was at one point almost a suspension of pit and ramming operations in this state because of the potential impact on the individual officers' driving records. I would also like to thank DMV for holding off on implementing what the AG had said how they should be interpreting this law, which gave us some time to get this correction passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm accompanied today by Mardell Ployer, who is a third-year, soon-to-be-a-third-year student at the very best law school on the West Coast, the University of Oregon.
Woo-hoo!
And, Ms. Ployer has prepared written testimony for the committee, and I would ask her to present some comments about the bill and about the -A2 amendments.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2569 amends the reporting requirement.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm sorry. I am Mardell Ployer here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice. House Bill 2569 amends the reporting requirements under ORS 811.720 to exempt officers from reporting intentional collisions caused in the course of their official law enforcement duties. Officers sometimes intentionally collide with another vehicle in order to apprehend a fleeing suspect or stop an out-of-control vehicle. These intentional collisions are referred to as pursuit intervention technique or PITS maneuvers. This bill is narrowly crafted and will not exempt officers from reporting accidents caused on behalf of their own negligence. Instead, it will prevent an officer from having to report a collision that the officer intentionally causes in order to protect the public safety. Officers should not have their driving record and personal insurance impacted by their use of a PIT maneuver. Under current law, as interpreted in a recent Attorney General opinion that has been discussed, officers will be forced to file an accident report for these intentional collisions. As a result, their driving record and personal automobile insurance will be impacted. Prior to the issuance of the Attorney General opinion, law enforcement agencies believed that PIT maneuvers did not have to be reported. Since that opinion was issued, however, it is clear that PIT maneuvers do qualify as accidents, and under current law, the DMV must report those collisions as accidents. I have prepared written testimony, which you should have, and in there I referred to the -3 amendment. I discovered today that is an error. It actually should be the -A2 amendment, so I apologize about that. The DOJ sponsors the -A2 amendments to this bill, which will expand the definition of the types of collisions that officers would be exempt from reporting. The A2 amendments would exempt an officer from reporting collisions that either involves a lawful intervention technique, such as a pit maneuver, or a person acting during the commission of a crime. The either-or language used in the A2 amendment takes into account a situation where an officer may have to use a pit maneuver to stop an out-of-control vehicle which doesn't actually involve a criminal act. Further, the language would encompass a situation where the collision is caused by a person's criminal act, but no pit maneuver is used. Without this bill, some law enforcement agencies and officers are reluctant to use pit maneuvers and will, therefore, be lacking an important law enforcement tool. I urge this committee to pass this bill so that law enforcement officers can use pit maneuvers without having their driving record impacted. I would be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Defines on page 2 lawful intervention technique. It says it means a method by which one motor vehicle causes or attempts to cause another motor vehicle to stop. Is that the only definition of lawful for these exempt techniques?
It's the only definition that I know of relating to this bill.
Because what would prevent an officer who just had, you know, was careless from saying, oh, well, I was trying to stop this other vehicle? I mean, what keeps this narrow, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it?
Sorry, I might have to defer to the Deputy Attorney General here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as we understand the definition, lawful intervention technique in itself implies the intentional use of the technique. That is to say, a technique is something that an officer employs knowingly with the intention of causing the motor vehicle to another motor vehicle to stop. So it is that language which permits the officer to which distinguishes between an officer who merely is involved in an accident and one who is engaged in the activity for which the officer has been trained to, as to which the officer has been trained.
Well, if there was a judgment call to be made, who would make the judgment call and determine whether they had to report? I mean, if an officer said, you know, got in an accident and said, well, I really intended to do this, I mean, is his word final or his or her word final?
If I may, again, Brian DeLeishman, Oregon Council Police Association, I don't believe so. I believe the employer obviously has the internal policies of when to use intervention techniques, which is widely understood as to what technique you use and under what circumstances. Mm-hmm. And if you had a situation in which an officer is trying to pawn it off as an intervention technique that wouldn't meet the policies of the employer, I suspect that the employer would say no, call foul, and that person, in fact, would have to report that as an accident rather than as a lawful intervention technique.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that it's important to understand that whatever kind of incident an officer in the course of duty might be involved in his or her vehicle, there are going to be a zillion reports to that officer's supervisors at the department. So I think in the first instance, there, as a practical matter, there likely would be a determination that involves the officer's supervisors. at the first level of whether this is going to be the kind of thing that needs to be, that must be reported under the law. So I think it would be not solely the individual officer, but rather the officer and his or her supervisors that would make the initial decision, much as individual citizen involved in an automobile accident has to make a determination for him or herself at the front end as to whether it falls in the category of the mandatory reportable accidents.
And if I may, Madam Chair, in most of these instances, you're really talking about a situation in which there is authorization, not only policies in place, but as the pursuit's going on, there is communication with supervisory personnel. And they say, go ahead, use the technique. There's an explicit authorization there. I don't know that it occurs very often in which the officer on their own employs this technique, one of these techniques.
But if they do employ the technique, are they required to report that they did that technique to their employer?
Internally, yes.
Okay, so I wonder if it might be a little bit clearer if we put... lawfully conducted and reported.
Madam Chair, I don't think that would do any violence to the basic principle of the bill. These are, I think it's safe to say, universally documented within the agency. Mr. Lashmi might know better about that, but it would surprise me if any of the incidents intended to be exempted from the reporting requirement would escape internal reporting within the agency. So that would it wouldn't do any violence to the requirements of the bill.
I don't know that it would do any violence. Obviously, we're anxious to get this in place, and it's obviously your call. But I think the record has been made in this hearing that we are talking about authorized or within the policy, and if they didn't meet that, and they would be reporting those incidents internally anyway, that I think we're already covered. But obviously, it's your call as the chair and the committee.
Council, do you have a comment?
Well, a couple of things, Madam Chair. Thank you. First, just as a point of illustration, when I was in college, I worked for the Portland Police Bureau in their records division and used to have to do the mail run and was rear-ended in one of the city's vehicles. And not only did I have to file a police report, I also had to go through the risk management in the city, and I think there are several layers of bureaucracy actually that are in place there. So I think any time that there's any damage to the officer's vehicle or if the officer causes damage to another person's vehicle, there's already going to be an internal requirement to deal with that because of the potential civil liabilities involved with any collision. All this bill is doing essentially is saying that there's not this additional DMV report
right. That's
a special form that you or I would have to fill out as a citizen that the officers would not have to fill out.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stark.
Seems to me that the main thrust of this would be to prevent the accident going on the insurance record of the officer, which would cause his personal insurance to go up. I think that it is a justified measure and that we probably have enough on the record here to move the bill.
I think so, Senator Starr. Well, I,
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
And just a couple questions, please.
Please.
First of all, I just want to clarify, you want us to approve the Dash 3 amendments?
Who?
Dash 2.
Okay, I'm looking at
the letter.
At the Dash A2 amendments.
Yes.
I was trying to understand, I'm comparing them to the language in the A engrossed bill. And which words are different?
Is that a question for the witnesses?
I think that's a question for you here.
I'm looking at the House Bill 2569-A2 amendments.
Yes.
I'm looking at the A engrossed bill.
Correct. I believe that it adds an or. in there. And so the original one has the official acting in the course of official duty if that accident involved a law enforcement official performing a lawful intervention technique and a person acting during the commission of offense. Then the amendment is a law enforcement official acting in the course of official duty if the accident involved a law enforcement official performing a lawful intervention technique or a law enforcement official and a person acting during the commission of a criminal offense. And the testimony indicated that the reason for that separating out is there are times when an officer will use that pursuit intervention technique in a non-criminal instance, particularly when a vehicle has lost control, and the way to sort of get regain control of that vehicle, be it because the driver is somehow incapacitated involuntarily or perhaps the vehicle is having problems, would be for the officer to bump that vehicle off the roadway and into a safer area.
Madam Chair, the amendment that I have here does still say and as Committee Counsel just described, the amendment was supposed to have an or in there.
It does.
The
or
dash
law.
Two does.
The dash 2 does. It says that the or is before, because I was confused by that too.
Oh, thank you.
Or a law enforcement. Yes. Does
great.
That clear it up?
Yep, that is.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, the process by which these are reported would make it very clear to the officer what they are exempt from and what they're not exempt from. And I presume other parts of the ORS would come after them if they did not report something that they were responsible for. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, there's heads shaking up and down as you're asking that question.
I've been seeing a lot of shaking in the audience. Senator Ringo.
A couple more questions, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Well, I just want to really make sure I understand the dash two amendments. You've got one clause of language, and then or a law enforcement official, and then you have the word and. In other words, like you have one or two and three. And I'm just trying to make sure I understand how they're all connected. Does this apply if you have a collision between a law enforcement official and a person acting in the commission of a crime?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that it is not a two-part test, but an either-or test. First of all, you have either the pit maneuver sort of situation where you have a law enforcement official performing a lawful intervention technique, and then you have or, the other option is you have a law enforcement official and a person who is acting during the commission of a criminal offense.
So the first part of that, then, you're not connecting it with, if you've got a law enforcement official acting in the course of, let's say a pit technique, that's all you need. You don't need
correct.
It to connect. So if they're performing a maneuver and they strike a third party, for example, an innocent third party, do they have to report it?
I believe that they would not be reporting it because it is as long as it is a lawful enforcement technique, then they would not be reporting it on their personal insurance.
Okay. And then I just meant, I'm sure that gives me a little bit of pause. If a police officer is cutting off somebody fleeing from a crime, that's one thing. But if they're performing a technique and they negligently hit a third party, you're saying they don't need to report that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think if, as I understand your concern, I think the real answer there is that it's again within policy. If they're performing a pit maneuver on a, let's say, vehicle number one, and somehow there's a vehicle number three that gets involved, did the officer in fact use the right policy and the right technique in dealing with vehicle number one? And in more cases than not, I mean, in a very high majority of the cases, that's the end of the operation. If another vehicle were, however, to be involved in that, does that justify the officer then, because they've employed the technique, to have to report that accident on their personal insurance and have their insurance adjusted, and again, keep in mind the focus of this is just their driving record for the purposes of insurance. So it does not put aside Obviously, the jurisdiction's liability, if somebody were to get injured in a third vehicle or a fourth vehicle, that's what counsel was talking about as far as risk management, the review of all the cases. What we're talking about here is the insurance, the DMV record and the insurance.
I guess my point, Madam Chair, I'm not sure what my conclusion is, but the Dash 2 amendments broaden it in a way that if the officer collides with third parties, to me that I need to think about it more carefully. I'll just put it that way.
Madam Chair, the very issue that Senator Ringo has identified kind of troubled me a little bit when we were working on the drafts of this, and here's the way I reasoned through it. One of the functions that the mandatory reporting requirement does in a citizen-on-citizen accident is it generates a record of what happened. In the absence of that required reporting, there wouldn't be a documented record that accounted for the more or less contemporaneous views of the various parties involved. You wouldn't have a diagram of who crashed into whom or what was observed or what was said about the incident. To me, because of the reality that police officers' life is consumed in doing paperwork, it seems often, and the reality that in any of these incidents, the officer is going to document the incident regardless of whether they have an obligation to report it in a DMV accident report form, it struck me that the documentation function of this is well satisfied, even where a third party incidentally is involved in the incident. That's how I adjust thought through the consequences of that, if that's helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, does that complete your question? Sorry, I'm finished. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Ringo, do you feel comfortable voting on this now, or do you want to?
I think if it's the will of the committee, go ahead and move it out.
Okay. We'll close. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2569, and we'll open a work session on 2569. Senator Starr.
Dash 2 amendments to 2569, House Bill 2569.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2569. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
I will vote no on the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Senator Ringo's objection is noted. Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2569 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2569 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
I'd be loved.
Okay. We're going to go into recess for about 15 minutes of the Judiciary Committee, so those of us who want to attend the governor's signing of the HCR 11, the Bob Coons Memorial, can go see it. We'll be back at 1:45.
Don't say you're adjourning.
think we'll reconvene the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for your indulgence. While we, some of us attended the governor's ceremony, which is still going on, which is why we're a little bit light here. But I think what we'll do is try to move out Senate Bill 424. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 424. And are you, you're staffing that? Right. Okay.
Chair Verdick, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 424 is the bill that you heard last week with respect to the Family Abuse Prevention Act and the discretion that the court may have in granting temporary custody of the party's children when the court is issuing a restraining order pursuant to FAPA. And there is a Dash 3 amendment that is before you that has one, or I should say two additions from the prior version that you saw last week. The two additions were at the suggestion of the committee. There was a request for a section with respect to the state court administrator tracking the number of these exceptional circumstances case that are either set or requested. That is now included in the bill. The other thing that is included in the Dash 3, and the other thing that is included in the Dash 3 is that the state court administrator will also develop training materials for use by the courts regarding these cases. To reflect your recollection, that the primary thing that the Dash 3 does is permits the court to, while there would be a presumption that temporary custody goes to the petitioner of the FAPA order, it does give the court the ability to determine that there are exceptional circumstances to warrant a special hearing to determine whether or not temporary custody would be granted to the respondent or the petitioner.
Okay. Committee, we've heard this in various iterations a couple of times. We have Melissa and Sybil in the audience to answer questions if we need them, but I think the council's summary was pretty straightforward. We're down to the point on the committee where everybody has to like it in order to move it at this time, so if anybody is having heartburn, please let me know now. We are in work session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 424.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 424. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 424 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 424 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry that bill. Thank you. Okay. Now we will. What do you recommend next?
Do you want to do 2222? Probably that one's
okay. Now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2222. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2222A is the measure that has to do with the Crime Victims Assistance section of the Department of Justice. This, you'll recall, creates a very detailed procedure by which the Crime Victims Assistance section can recover money that it pays out to recipients who are successful in obtaining damages against a responsible party. It requires the recipient of victims' assistance to notify the Department of Justice when that recipient makes a claim or brings an action against a third party based on the underlying event that was the basis for the assistance. And instead of a garden variety claim against the victim's recovery from a third party, this measure gives the Crime Victims Assistance section an automatic lien on any judgment or settlement that is recovered by the crime victim from a third party. There are no amendments before you, and the measure passed the House 55-0 with 5 excused.
Thank you. This seems like a common sense measure. We probably have people we could drag up here if we needed to. Do any committee members have questions, Council? Okay, Senator Starr, we're in work session.
Move House Bill 2222. The Senate floor is the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2222 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any Senator Whitson?
Chair Burdick, I'll support this bill, but I just want to point out that it really does look like the cost of this bill may actually exceed the benefits of it from the figures that we have here. But it's from the last, over the last 5 years, there's been an uncollected balance of about $50,000 that was identified, which is $10,000 a year. However, they indicate that there is a possibility or potential for more, and I think these people should be paying back what is has been loaned to them, so to speak. So I will support the bill.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other discussion on House Bill 2222?
Bill should pass.
Dumb bill should pass? Okay. For the record, Senator Beyer. Okay. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, I think you should carry this.
If you want.
Yeah, why not? We need a good something to get people's attention. Okay. Now we will, before we move on, I'm wondering, we passed, Senator Brzezinski and Senator Walker, we passed Senate Bill 424 out with the Dash 3 amendments while you were gone. And I know, Senator Walker, the Dash 3 incorporated comments that you had made in the last session about the court keeping track of how these are going.
Oh, yeah.
And if you would like a chance to vote, I could seek a suspension to let you do that.
Okay.
Would you like to do that?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. I got way late in the hallway. Bye.
Okay, I'd like unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Senator Walker and Senator Brzezinski to vote. Any objection? So, ordered. Senator Walker, how do you vote?
I vote aye because I understand these are all the consensus amendments and they capture what I had questions about. So,
Senator Walker will be recorded as an aye vote on Senate Bill 424. Senator Brzezinski,
aye.
How do you vote? Senator Brzezinski votes aye on Senate Bill 424. Okay, so ordered. Now we will open.
I think so. That's Bill's bill.
Okay. Mr. Taylor, we're going to take your bill up next, so get ready. We will open a work session on House Bill 2281.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2281 comes to you from the Judicial Department, and it modifies provisions governing circuit courts and appellate courts relating to fees for administrative services, interpreters, and jurors. Madam Chair, members of the committee, at the last hearing of this bill before the committee on the 2nd of May, there were a lot of issues around the filing fee issue, the filing fee, the charge for the copying of records. And you have before you the Dash 1 amendments, which make a slight change in the bill, which would say now on the law, in the statute, the proposed statute, 25 cents of the actual cost of copying. And what this does, this is a, for papers, copies, records may not exceed 25 cents per page, except for records whose additional services are required. If additional services are required, fees for providing the records are subject to RS 192440. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that says in pertinent section, the public body may establish fees reasonably calculated to reimburse it for its actual cost in making such records available, including costs for summarizing, compiling, or tailoring such record, either an organization or media to meet the person's request. Mr. Swank is here from the Judicial Department. If you have any further questions concerning that.
Okay, why don't you come on up, Mr. Swank, in case there's any questions. Let's see, the bill that we passed just the other day
was Representative Ackerman's bill?
Yes. Would that provision, if the costs are going to be more than 25 cents a page, would that bill require the court to notify that the costs, about what the costs would be?
Sure. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. Yes, it would. We deliberately dovetailed with Chair Ackerman's bill from the House in this amendment. We did that because the procedure that they adopted in his bill was one that we were already following, and that's to notify people if the costs are going to exceed a certain amount. By referencing the public records section, it also allows us to waive fees where appropriate, and it just ties in with the procedures that we're using.
So for the record, Representative Ackerman's the scheme in his bill would go into ORS 192.440, and so that would dovetail into this.
Correct, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was opposed to this bill when first heard it, but with the Dash 1 amendments, I think it corrects the concerns that I had.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? Okay, Senator Starr, we're in work session. We have a Dash 1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2281.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2281. Are there any, is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2281 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2281 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. All right. For what?
Well, 2024, I think Fussner and Gartland are here on
that. Okay. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2224. And that's not ready to vote. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2224A would require the appellate court, after reversing some but not all counts on appeal, to remand the case to the trial court for resentencing on the remaining counts. This bill is here at the request of the Attorney General's office, and in my SMS, you'll note that I cited to a specific case where a defendant had been sentenced by the trial court on several counts. Some of those counts were sentenced consecutively and some concurrently. When some of those counts were reversed on appeal, the defendant ended up getting a 200-month reduction in his prison sentence from 300 to 100 months because of the way that the case was remanded for trial.
Okay, thank you. And we have people signed up for this. 2224. Okay, let's see, we'll start with Jonathan Fussner. Welcome.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers to ask your support for House Bill 2224. The difficulty that this bill is designed to fix is the situation where a defendant has multiple counts and gets convicted of them. Let's take as an illustration two counts, and the court imposes sentences concurrently. Goes up on appeal. One of those counts is reversed outright, not being sent back for resentencing or a new trial, just it's gone. At that point, under the current law, it's unclear whether the Court of Appeals can send the remaining count back to the trial judge for resentencing. We think it makes sense to do that, to allow the trial judge, if it's lawful to do that, to reimpose a sentence that approaches or duplicates the original total overall sentence that was imposed the first time around. If the remaining convictions are not remanded for resentencing, defendants can suffer adverse consequences, and they can also get windfall reductions in what their proper sentence should be. Essentially, this, I would suggest, is a sort of a fairness bill. It gives more flexibility to the trial courts to ensure that defendants get the kinds of sentences that they originally believed those defendants ought to get. I would like to just touch on a couple of issues, because I know Mr. Gartland is going to testify before you in a moment, and he has kindly shared his objections to this bill with me. One of the objections to the bill is we don't really need this, because in a case called State versus Rodvelt, the Court of Appeals did remand the remaining convictions after, in essence, reversing some convictions of a multiple count appeal. The reason why I don't think that the Rodvelt case solved this problem is that Rodvelt didn't exactly involve a case where a conviction was vacated or reversed on appeal. It involved multiple convictions where the court said two of the convictions should have merged into two of the other convictions, so there really should have only been two convictions instead of four separate ones. Under those circumstances, the court did send all the convictions that remained back down for resentencing. But it didn't. It involved a merger issue, not a reversal issue. That may make a difference. The other key problem with the Rodvelt opinion as a fix for this problem is there was a very lengthy, detailed, vigorous dissent in that case on this very issue by Judge Edmonds, one of the presiding judges of the panels of the Court of Appeals. And because this was a decision only by a three-judge panel, it is not clear what the total 10-member court would do with this issue if they were faced with it. That's why I suggest that it is necessary to clarify the law now rather than simply waiting to litigate this over the coming years case by case. Mr. Gartman's second objection, I believe, is going to be that there may be a constitutional problem with sending cases back for resentencing where the convictions did not all arise out of the same criminal episode, the same basic crime.
Why don't we let Mr. Gartland speak for himself, and then you can come back if you need.
Certainly, Chair Burdick, I just would say one final thing, and that is the applicability of this bill to cases involving only misdemeanors. We were intending to get an amendment to this bill completed before today that would make it clear that this applies only to cases involving some felony counts, not to cases where you have two or three misdemeanors that go up on appeal. Not because we don't think it would be fair to apply it, simply as a matter of resources. It's probably not necessary to apply it to misdemeanors because often those sentences are completely served by the time the appeal is over. It's more significant that it apply to cases involving felonies, and my understanding is there is a draft underway as we speak in Legislative Council to make that change, which I support. I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fischner, would you explain to me why this bill would not, why this resentencing authorization would not represent potential double jeopardy through enhanced sentencing?
Well, Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsitt, we currently resentence all counts of cases in which there is one count sent back for resentencing. We've had this statute, ORS 138.222 sub 5, on the books for a number of years now. And as I say, when you have a group of cases or convictions arising out of one appeal where they're sentenced at the same time, if one of them needs to go back for resentencing, they are all sent back for resentencing. And there has never been a successful challenge to the resentencing on those other counts based on any kind of double jeopardy concerns. And I would suggest that such a challenge, while it's an interesting theory, I'm not saying there's absolutely nothing to it, but I think it's more theoretical than real. Because generally what governs the resentencing is statutory law. And as I say, we've already been doing this in most cases that require resentencing. All this bill would do is to expand it to cases where technically there isn't a case that needs to go back to be resentenced, but in fact they ought to go back to be resentenced. Secondly, I think the former Jeopardy protections apply to being tried twice for the same offense, and that's not what's involved here. What's involved here is a person is tried, a person is convicted, let's say, of four counts arising from a criminal episode. The judge then imposes in one proceeding a series of sentences that add up to one total overall sentence. If some of those counts have a sentencing problem or under this bill are reversed outright, everything goes back and the judge gets to reimpose a sentence that still would be limited by the total overall sentence that was imposed the first time. And I think that's what takes care of any former Jeopardy or other constitutional objection. We're not increasing the total amount of the sentence that a defendant receives. We're simply altering the mix among the sentences that were initially imposed to reach a sentence that's no more severe overall.
Madam Chair. So if there were four convictions and, you know, A, B, C, and D, and A and B were overturned, and they sent all, the appellate court sent all four back for resentencing, the judge could then enhance the sentences for C and D to meet with the original A, B, C, and D. That would seem to me to be, whether double jeopardy or whatever, it would certainly be an enhancement of what the judge originally decided or what the jury originally decided.
Well, as I say, there is that argument there. I'm just not convinced that that would persuade our courts that there's a constitutional problem with it, and that probably is something that we would have to litigate eventually if either under this bill or under the existing statute where it works the same way. But as I say, we've never seen a challenge of that sort in the years that that bill's been on the books.
In the scenario that you mentioned, if you sent them back in today's environment, we're about to discuss the Blakely fix on the floor tomorrow. So if these sentences come back, would they have to be, if the judge manipulated some of the other sentences on individual counts, to be higher than the original sentence had been to try to achieve the overall result, would that be an upward departure that would have to go to a jury?
Madam Chair, I believe that if it were done by way of a departure, if it were done by way of a departure sentence, presumably yes, in most cases that would be a Blakely departure that would have to go to a jury, or the defendant would have to admit to those departure factors or waive a jury trial, which probably is mostly how they would be handled. On the other hand, you might often have situations, for example, where you have multiple counts and they are all sentenced concurrently. A couple of them drop out. It goes back for resentencing. The court at that time may be able to impose some of those sentences consecutively without doing any departures, and at least it's our view that Blakely would not apply to a consecutive sentencing decision. So I think a lot of what we're looking at here would not implicate Blakely, but certainly if it were a departure sentence being made on remand, then Blakely would apply to it.
Well, but this committee went to hear the arguments in the Court of Appeals on whether Blakely does apply to consecutive sentences. I believe that decision has not been handed down yet, but there are a number of people who believe that consecutive sentences will be interpreted as upward departures, and if they are, then if the court takes that type of measure, they would have to make a Blakely finding. Okay, which would, of course, involve a fiscal, but we don't know that at this point. Is the most common use of this, as far as you can predict, to change concurrent sentences to consecutive ones?
Well, That's very difficult to answer. I simply don't know the answer to that, whether under the current statute, when cases go back for that kind of global resentencing, whether the courts generally have been using departure sentences or changing consecutive sentences. I'm sorry, I just don't know that.
Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will now hear from Pete Gartland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be back. Members of the committee.
Good to have you.
My name is Peter Gartland. I'm with the Legal Services Division of the Office of Public Defense Services. And as Mr. Fustin was alluding to, I'm here in opposition to this bill. I think for this committee, this is becoming everything you wanted to know about sentencing, but we're afraid to ask. And this is starting to sound like an appellate argument. But I think the central core concept at issue here, and Senator Whitsitt, you touched on it very heavily, is what is a case and what are counts? And our view under the law, a case is those offenses that arise in the same criminal episode. And the same criminal episode is a term of art. And typically it means a crime spree for, 20 minutes. Somebody commits three crimes and, with some sort of intent. There's some sort of common scheme, and it's joined in time and place and circumstance. And our view would be, in that instance, if one conviction is reversed and sent back, then yes, the trial court could sentence, impose different sentences on the other offenses within that episode. But most cases are joined for trial, not from the same criminal episode, but from different criminal episodes. So a lot of times, or most times, somebody might, let's say, be charged with theft several different days in a row, Monday through the rest of the week. And the prosecutor can move to join those for trial, and there's a statute that permits it. It's called permissive joinder. And it's done, those cases are joined for purposes of conservation of judicial and system-wide resources and administrative ease. So there's no legal principle compelling that joinder. The principle that compels that joinder in that instance is just conservation of resources. So our position is simply those are separate cases. And if they were treated the way they should be treated in the theoretical world, when we all have the amount of resources we should have, there would be separate trials in separate courtrooms, and that individual could appeal one, all, or several of those convictions, and they go up to the appellate court, and the appellate court might reverse one. Or he may not, he may only appeal one conviction, and the appellate court might reverse that. There would be no way for the other courts to reach into those other cases and adjust those sentences because those are separate cases. And that would, and if the court did that, that would raise the questions that Senator Whitsitt mentioned, double jeopardy problems, and also equal protection problems. If you think about two defendants, same charges, seven thefts, 7 days in a row. One defendant is tried separately, seven different trials, challenges one conviction on appeal, the appellate court reverses, the other six convictions and sentences remain there. Why would it be fair? What's the equal treatment under the state's plan or theory or bill for the defendant who was tried together? All the counts were tried together in one trial, and he challenges one conviction, and the Court of Appeals reverses, and it goes back. What's the logic or principle that would allow the judge to amend the sentences on the other counts that were unaffected, that were not appealed at all? So there are constitutional problems with the state's bill, and in any event, as the state mentioned, the state has the current law right now in the Court of Appeals is as the state requests. So in the first instance, I don't see a reason to enact something if it's already the law. And then the second, this bill and even current law has constitutional problems underpinning it. So I don't think there's a benefit to double the constitutional problems.
Under your scenario, if they were tried, say they did 7 different thefts, they were tried in different courts, and et cetera, what you would have in that scenario is, in effect, consecutive sentences. Isn't that correct?
Well, the judge in each case looks at the person's criminal history, looks at what they're serving now, and decides whether or not to impose consecutive or concurrent sentences.
Right, but I mean, in the scenario that you gave, if you said that the court does it as a matter of efficiency and convenience, but if they were to exactly duplicate the scenario you gave of separate trials and separate courts for separate crimes, then they would all be consecutive. The court wouldn't make any of them concurrent. Isn't that correct?
No. The court has the authority to make a sentence that the court's currently imposing concurrent.
That's correct, but if you had separate courts,
mm-hmm.
you know, courtroom A convicts somebody for theft, and courtroom B, different judge, different court, convicts them for another theft,
mm-hmm.
The courtroom B can't make it concurrent with a separate decision made in another court, can they?
Madam Chair, currently, yes. That is the law. The judge in courtroom B can make the sentence concurrent with the sentence that was imposed in courtroom A.
That was previously given. And then if they tried them all together in the same courtroom, the judge would be able to make that determination.
Right, and I understand the same courtroom thing, but...
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I mean, if I was arguing the case as a prosecutor, I would basically argue that they should be consecutive. He could stand up and say that should be concurrent to the sentence that was imposed by Judge A 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge in the second case would have that fact in front of him, and he or she would make the determination whether the second sentence would be consecutive or concurrent mm-hmm. to the one that had already been imposed.
So that decision can be made anyway. So what you're saying is that if one of those thefts get thrown back, mm-hmm. thrown out, then to come back and try to fill in, if you will, the time that was lost from that one is what you're objecting to.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair. That's the intent, I think, behind the state's bill.
Okay. And do you see, I mean, you talk about double jeopardy, but do you see a Blakely issue at all there as well?
Yes. As we know with, Madam Chair, as we know with Blakely, we're kind of, we're on the cutting edge, and everything that's happening is kind of new, and nobody really knows what the result is going to be. But, yeah, it will be the same kind of Blakely issues are going to pop up there, because it's going to require impaneling a jury to hear. Well, this assumes that consecutive sentencing is a Blakely issue, and as Mr. Fussner represented, that's not crystal clear yet.
Right.
The Court of Appeals have said that they will not address an unpreserved consecutive sentencing issue, but they have not addressed the merits. So if an attorney, a defense attorney below, properly objects to the imposition of consecutive sentences and argues that Blakely requires a jury finding on that, we don't have case law yet to say whether or not that is in fact a Blakely issue.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will close the hearing on House Bill 2224 and withhold action on this. There is an amendment coming, and I think we all want to give this a little more consideration. So now we will open up We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2227. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2227 would authorize the introduction of victim impact evidence in situations where aggravated murder has been charged, but in the sentencing phase, the death penalty is not being considered. As I wrote in my staff measure summary, there are essentially three possible outcomes when a person has been convicted of aggravated murder, the first being death penalty, the second being life without the possibility of release or parole, and the third being 30 years to life. The issue here is if there are times when the state would declare they would not seek the death penalty, the number one reason, of course, being if the charged defendant is a juvenile. And the question is whether or not the victim's family or victim representatives would be able to present impact evidence in a non-death penalty aggravated murder sentencing phase. House Bill 2227 would make it clear that the victim impact evidence would be admissible.
Thank you. And Mr. Fussner, you're back on again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jonathan Fussner from the Department of Justice. This is a Department of Justice bill that I think is essentially just a housekeeping type bill. We have a statute already, as I pointed out in my written testimony, that explicitly states that victim impact evidence of a certain kind is admissible in an aggravated murder penalty phase proceeding, and that is under the section that deals with where the death penalty is being sought. But for unknown reasons, that same language did not make it into subsection 3 of that statute, which deals with cases in which the person was under 18 when they committed the murder, or the state is not choosing to seek the death penalty, and the only issue before the jury is whether to impose a true life sentence as opposed to life with the possibility of parole. I believe that the constitutional law is clear that there is no constitutional problem with the admission of victim impact evidence in those kinds of cases. We simply have a hole in the statute where our statute does not say one way or the other whether that kind of evidence is admissible. This House Bill 2227 would clarify the law, make it clear that victim impact evidence is admissible in any aggravated murder penalty phase proceeding, irrespective of whether the death sentence is being sought. Other than that, if I can answer questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Kelly Skye and Richard Wolf.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Wolf. I'm a criminal lawyer. I've been practicing in Oregon for 18 years. And Mr. Fussner and I have often been on the opposite side of arguments before the Court of Appeals, Oregon Supreme Court. And in fact, this term, his boss, Ms. Mary Williams, Solicitor General, and I will be arguing a case in the U.S. Supreme Court, which to some degree may impact the amendments that this court is contemplating making to the aggravated murder statute. And what I'd like to do is start off by telling you, first of all, that the reason that this language is not in this portion of the aggravated murder statute is because this is a very different type of proceeding than the proceeding in which death is a contemplated sentence. I want you to imagine for a moment that you're a jury and you've just heard an aggravated murder case involving a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old individual, and or perhaps the person has already pled guilty to that crime, and you have been impaneled as the jury to determine that person's sentence. Now, the judge is going to instruct you that if 10 of you agree that there are sufficient mitigating circumstances, then you may grant that individual the possibility of parole after they've served 30 years in prison. It's not a guarantee they're going to get out. it is the possibility, depending on their conduct in prison during that 30 years. Otherwise, the presumptive sentence, the sentence that shall be imposed if only 9 people think he should get paroled, if no person thinks he should get paroled, the presumptive sentence is true life, life in prison without the possibility of parole. So the question then becomes, how does this amendment help the jury answer the question, are there sufficient mitigating circumstances? Because, quite frankly, I've tried a number of aggravated murder cases, and I have yet to find one where the victims are not severely impacted by the death of the person, by their loved one. Victims are always impacted by this event. How does that help the jury determine whether that particular defendant should get a true life sentence or a life without, or a life with the possibility of parole? Are we trying to say that some people's lives are more valuable than others? Because that is, in effect, what victim impact evidence does. Are we to say to the jury, well, Mr. Defendant, you killed a homeless person or a drug dealer, so, you know, we're going to give you the possibility of parole, as opposed to if the person killed is a police officer or father or mother of many children? The two do not equate. And the question that the jury is to answer is, the focus is on the defendant. And a number of victims often feel that the process is very unfair in that respect. There's all this talk about the defendant, and there's all this talk about his unfortunate upbringing and things of this nature. And there's a reason for that. That is because the proceeding which is occurring is between the state of Oregon and that defendant. And that is what the focus of the case needs to be about. If a victim feels that their loved one's life has been improperly taken away from them, there is a perfectly valuable and pre-existing method by which they can get this type of evidence brought before a court and a jury. They can bring a wrongful death suit, and they can sue for the loss of companionship, consortium, all of these things. And this information can be put before a jury and a determination made about what kind of loss that person suffered. Now, I want to tell you that Mr. Fussner's comments about the constitutionality of enacting this type of provision being clear, I think, is far from the case. And I need to just give you a brief history of the Oregon aggravated murder statute. In 1984, when the people enacted the death penalty statute in Oregon again, they chose to adopt as a model the state of Texas death penalty statute. And the jury was asked to decide, under that original statute, 3 questions. Whether the victim provoked the attack, whether the person was likely to commit future acts of violence that constitute a continuing threat to society, and the third one, they're all right here in the statute as they exist, A, B, and C. And the third one being, first one is whether the deceased,
whether it was committed deliberately,
whether the defendant acted deliberately. So the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case out of Texas, decided that those 3 questions were not sufficient to give effect to a person's mitigating circumstances. And that was a case of Johnny Paul Penry. And in Penry, the Oregon's, as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Penry, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in Jeffrey Scott Wagner's case that our statute was invalid, and we need to have this 4th question added, which the court actually amended the statute, and the legislature subsequently passed its own amendment that gave effect to the court's ruling. But the difference between the 4th question and the 5th question is significant. The problem is that the defendant has the burden in the 5th question. The state doesn't have to show anything. The sentence is already true life unless the defendant can show mitigating circumstances. That's very different than a death penalty proceeding, in which the presumptive sentence, again, is true life, but for the state to convince a jury to sentence someone to death, they need to convince the jury of additional circumstances, aggravating evidence. And if that aggravating evidence exists, then a person can be sentenced to death. Now, if this amendment occurs, what we will have in the fifth question is the same problem that we presently have in the fourth question, and that is that there is no weighing of these aggravating and mitigating circumstances. This stuff is just thrown to the jury with, and the Oregon Supreme Court has already said there is no burden of proof on the fourth question. So the jury is not told that they have to find these things beyond a reasonable doubt or who bears the burden of proof. And I want this committee to know that just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari in a case called Kansas versus Marsh. And Kansas has a death penalty statute that says if aggravating and mitigating factors are in equipoise, in other words, equal, then a defendant may be sentenced to death. The Kansas Supreme Court said that statute is unconstitutional. The state must prove aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, and the aggravating factors must outweigh the mitigating factors. And the state of Kansas petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to hear that case, and the question that the court granted certiorari on is, does it violate the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, for a state capital sentencing statute to provide for the imposition of the death penalty when the sentencing jury determines that the mitigating and aggravating evidence is in equipoise? So, if this committee determines that this language should be enacted, I'm here to tell you that one of the arguments that I intend to make, ultimately, is that this statute fails to require any weighing. And absent weighing, and absent aggravating factors outweighing mitigating factors, such a statute is unconstitutional. And that's the very question the U.S. Supreme Court is going to decide in Texas next term. It's going to have a December argument date. So you're chartering on very untested waters, I would submit. And the cost of a miscalculation is going to be quite expensive, because if aggravating evidence is admitted in these proceedings, the U.S. Supreme Court rules in Mr. Marsh's favor, these cases are going to have to be retried, and that's an expensive proposition. Not to mention, as
Senator Brzezinski, would the whole case need to be retried, or just the sentencing under those scenarios?
Under it, the resentencing would need to be retried.
Thank you.
Which is often the bulk of many of these cases, especially, you know, if you have a guilty plea, the sentencing proceeding can still take quite a number of weeks, and then having to gather witnesses back up, and all that is quite a undertaking for both the state and the defendant. But the
Chair.
Senator Barr.
Follow on that. If the state chose not to retry the sentencing, would the presumptive sentence of life without parole just become the sentence?
Well, I don't believe so. The last provision of the present statute, subsection 4, says if any part of subsection 2 is held invalid, and as a result thereof, a defendant who has been sentenced to life without the possibility of release or parole will instead be sentenced to life imprisonment in the custody of the department for a period of 30 years. So, no, they would probably get a possibility of parole sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, in sentencing hearings for aggravated murder, are character witnesses and mitigating circumstances allowed for the defense? And is that testimony required to be proven, and if so, at what level?
It is admissible. It is permitted. And in this
in the context which these amendments operate, what we call the fifth question, whether you should have the possibility of parole, it is the defendant's burden, and it has been held by the court to be a preponderance of the evidence, in other words, the same standard as in a civil case, that the defendant must convince 10 jurors that those mitigating circumstances warrant the possibility of parole.
Madam Chair, perhaps I didn't make myself clear. Is the testimony required to be proven? Those individuals who come forth as character witnesses and those witnesses who come forward with character references and mitigating circumstances, is that testimony required to be proven by the court?
Well, when you say proven, if a witness is called, let's say I have a client who was sexually abused as a child and beaten as a child, and I call that person's caretaker or a DHS health worker or something to testify about the effects that that has had on my client, the jury hears that evidence and they give it the weight they deem it to be worth. If they deem it to be a sufficient mitigating circumstance that entitles my client to the possibility of parole after 30 years, then that's what they are deliberating about when they're trying to reach their decision. But I don't know if that answers your question, but the proof that the judge is going to instruct the jury is that the defendant is going to have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that these mitigating circumstances are sufficient to entitle the person the opportunity of parole after 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, that's a really difficult hurdle to overcome. I've never seen an aggravated murder case that wasn't heinous. They're all really dreadful cases. Mm-hmm. And the average juror is really offended by the person's conduct. But another thing you have to take into consideration is this bill we're talking about is for people who either were under 18 at the time of the crime, or the DA has already decided they're not going to seek the death penalty on for whatever reason, which we're not always privy to. But it's already difficult enough to convince a jury to grant the possibility of parole, and then what you have is a young person who goes into the correction system with no incentive whatsoever to modify their behavior, to conform to the rules of the institution. They got nothing to lose. And to grant the possibility of parole, to have that carrot in front of a person who's looking at doing 30 years, is a real benefit to the people who have to house these individuals. And so, not to mention, those who are denied the possibility of parole, sure, when they're young and full of testosterone, they're quite a handful to manage, but once they get up to around 40s, 50s, 60s, people tend to mellow out quite a bit, but they also tend to become not healthy. And these people are sentenced to the legal and physical custody of the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon taxpayers are going to pay for all of their medical infirmities once they're 70 years old and still sitting in the penitentiary. So these are things that need to be considered when amendments like this are contemplated. And these are all things I think that factor into it. Because once they're denied the possibility of parole, that's it. They're locked up, and they're the state's obligation till they die. But if the parole board, which I would submit to you, is quite conservative in deciding who they should and should not release, and they release very few people, except those that they deem deserving, and they're looking at a 30-year track record, if they deem them worthy of parole after 30 years, then they can grant them that option. But if they're denied that opportunity, these people never go before the parole board.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
The defendant in this case can offer mitigating evidence as to why he or she deserves the possibility of parole.
Correct.
In isn't it appropriate in that calculation to allow for the aggravating circumstances to somehow come into play?
Well, but this offers victim impact evidence. And
I understand that. But, I mean, one of the things, you were critical of this bill because it doesn't allow for any weighing of
right.
that. I mean, what if the bill did allow for the weighing of that? What if it allowed for weighing the aggravating circumstances with the mitigating circumstances in deciding whether to allow for the possibility of parole?
Well, I think it's an inappropriate consideration. I don't think that a jury should be asked to decide that a person who's the victim who has family members who are impacted greater than someone who, say, was homeless. I think the homeless person deserves the same protection under the law,
but that calculation is permitted if the death penalty is a possibility.
Well, but this
and you're not here to suggest that be changed.
But this is in non-death cases.
I understand. I'm just saying, if you can do the weighing to go from this point up to the death penalty, why isn't it appropriate to do the weighing to go from possibility of parole to no possibility? Why shouldn't you be able to weigh that?
Well, again, how does the fact that a person who committed an aggravated murder, which had a family who was greatly impacted, how does that make them more or less deserving of the possibility of parole?
Well, we say that can be used in deciding whether they ought to be put to death.
And again, I don't think it's an appropriate consideration in that context either, and whether or not an absence of weighing in that portion of the statute is something that's going to have to be decided by on another day. And again, I don't really see how it does help a jury decide. You know, you take your victims as you find them, and if you cause the death of another human being, it's what your conduct is and what your actions are and what danger you may present in the future that should determine whether you'd be sentenced to death or not, whether you killed a really famous person or an obscure person.
But it seems to me you're arguing that really there's no place for offering aggravating evidence. If that's what you're arguing, and I mean, is that what you're arguing?
Well, victim impact evidence, I think that the proper place for it is in a wrongful death suit. And
death suit. These people don't have money. The victim's families. I mean, you're never going to get a wrongful death suit on these cases.
Well, I don't know that necessarily makes it appropriate when society is deciding how long to house or whether to permanently incarcerate someone. It that doesn't necessarily make it right to put it in that proceeding either, because it really doesn't help a jury answer the question of whether there are mitigating circumstances.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes.
Thanks. Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm listening to the logic, and I agree on the balancing. It seems to me that there has to be balancing on either side. And a whole system has been set up where both aggravating and mitigating circumstances are normally allowed. And I understand your argument based on how that statute's read. Well, I look at the Constitution under Article 1, Section 42, Rights of Victims, where it says that the victim has the right to be heard at sentencing. I mean, I'm having a real difficult time saying, how do I take that statute, which may be not in line with what is currently in our Constitution for the state. But clearly, it seems to me that even though the mandatory sentence in this case would be a life without the possibility of parole, we know that's what they are looking at. Even in the Measure 11 offenses, which has those mandatory minimums, you have both sides being able to establish the aggravating as well as the mitigating circumstances. And to me, in this statute where we're talking about a person whose life has been taken, should be no different than if it was a sexual offense that's a Measure 11 offense. And if you can have it there, it seems like it should be here. And I do agree that there has to be some balancing. It seems to me whoever the trier of fact for that sentencing is, be it a jury or the judge, he or she or those group of individuals have to have presented to them everything. And then they make a decision based on that, knowing that the what the mandatory minimum sentence would be, or the mandatory sentence, not minimum sentence, without the mitigating circumstances.
Well, then there's also the question of recently a case in Multnomah County, the parents of the victim, of the child victim, did not want the death penalty for the individual, yet that information was excluded from the jury's consideration. And that would certainly seem to be, if that's the logic that applies, then all the wishes should be known, whether they just be aggravating wishes, this crime has impacted me terribly and I want this person to die, or I want this person to be locked up forever, equally along with the victims who feel that the person deserves another opportunity perhaps in 30 years or should not get the death penalty and when we're talking about the first questions.
Madam Chair, it would seem to me that the victim or the representative of the victim would be able to make those statements based on what's provided for within the Constitution. Even though the prosecution may not agree with it, it seems to me that they have that right to say that.
The other question that if this amendment is permitted is passed is the question of at what point does it apply? In other words, for crimes which have already been committed, does it apply retroactively to them, or will it only apply to crimes that have occurred since the bill may be enacted? Because that is an important question which in the case which I'll be arguing this fall before the U.S. Supreme Court is an issue that we're trying to get before the court as well concerning retroactive application, because I think it's pretty clear that this type of evidence is generally deemed aggravating evidence and therefore makes it more difficult for a defendant to achieve the possibility of parole, and therefore its retroactive application would be an ex post facto violation. Unless there are other questions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. I'm going to call Steve Dolan. Mr. Fessner, can you join him up here? Because we did have a question that came out of the previous comments, and that is whether it would be appropriate to insert a provision adding a weighing requirement into this bill.
Respond to that. I think that Mr. Wolf accurately described the way sentencing procedure is undertaken currently, and that is that there is, in a capital case or a death penalty is on the table, there is no burden of proof one way or the other, but that the jury does weigh all the factors and makes a decision. And that if it is a case in which the death penalty is not on the table, then the presumptive sentence is life with the life without the possibility of parole, and the burden of persuasion is on the defendant to persuade the jury to grant life with the possibility of parole. I think that those, the way those are set up currently, they contemplate the jury weighing the evidence and considering all the evidence. So I don't know that there's any need to insert a specific statement saying victim impact evidence is admissible and the jury shall consider it or shall weigh it. I think that's how it works now.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Pazansky.
When the court goes to charge the jury at the time for sentencing, would the instruction basically say what the sentence should be under the law unless they find for mitigating circumstances that it should be, then it would be something else?
That's my understanding, is that the instructions would be along the lines of if 10 or more of your number believe that a sentence of less than life without the possibility of parole is appropriate, then that's the sentence that you should vote for, essentially. But that the defendant has the burden to persuade the jurors of that fact, and if the defendant can't persuade 10 of them or more, then the default sentence is true life.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
But then what instruction is the jury going to get in terms of what are they supposed to do with the
aggravating evidence, in this case the victim impact evidence. Are they going to be instructed what to do with that?
Well, I don't want to just give you an answer too much off the top of my head, but my belief is that there is no specific instruction. Certainly there is not one that's mandated by statute. Generally, the instructions that are given are from the Uniform Criminal Jury Instructions book that a committee of the state bar puts out to guide judges, but it's not mandatory. I don't believe they're given a specific instruction on this type of evidence or that. What they're told is that they are the judges of the evidence in the case and that they are to consider all of the evidence in the case in reaching their verdict.
I guess, Madam Chair, I'm just following up on a comment of the gentleman who just testified that said, well, the jury's not told what to do with that evidence. And at least with respect to when you're looking at the death penalty, they are told. They're told to weigh it. You know, and in this case, we're not telling them, and I'm wondering if we need to.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, I really am not sure I can respond to that beyond saying that I think that the instructions that are generally given to jurors in these cases are pretty carefully thought out, and I think that they adequately convey to the jury the notion that they are supposed to weigh all of the evidence in the case, and it may be a matter for another day as to whether jury instructions should be crafted that would be more specific and would say, particularly you are to weigh aggravating and mitigating evidence in these cases, or weigh victim impact evidence as against aggravating.
Well, just to clarify, right now, if we pass the bill as it's written, would you expect that the jury would receive an instruction to say, you are to weigh the mitigating evidence against the aggravating evidence in determining whether to allow for the possibility of parole?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, I don't think that enacting this bill would do anything one way or the other to change whatever the current practice is, and I'm going to have to just assume that an instruction is not given in these kinds of cases that literally says you are to weigh the aggravating as against the mitigating evidence. It could be, perhaps.
Well, Madam Chair, there probably isn't at this point because we don't have that aggravating evidence coming in.
Sorry.
And the way that the statute, I think what Senator Ringo's getting at, is that once you interject that, then you're going to have this body of evidence that's going to be coming before the trier. And at some point, it seems like you need to tell them or give them some type of instructions as to what, if anything, they can do and how that goes into the deliberation. Because right now, the current law, it appears that that's not coming in, and all they're basically told is that you shall impose this sentence unless you find from 10 of your members to mitigate this down.
You know, Madam Chair, frankly, I was hoping that you had just answered yes to my question, and then we would have had some, at least, record that the intention was to allow some weighing.
Can I ask just a point of clarification for Mr. Fussner? I note that the case that I think your office pointed me to, State versus George at least, that victim impact evidence did come in a non-death penalty aggravated murder sentencing. So at least that has happened in the past, correct? And I take from your testimony you don't know exactly what occurred or how the jury was instructed in that case, but at least in some jurisdictions, the practice is occurring. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, I think that is accurate, that it has come in the past. It's also accurate. I don't know what jury instructions were given in State versus George. The Court of Appeals approved the admission of this evidence. The Supreme Court then took the case, decided it on a different issue, and specifically declined to decide whether victim impact evidence is admissible. If I may, I think Senator Ringo's concern is one that we ought to talk about briefly, and it's this. Evidence comes into these sentencing hearings of all different sorts already, and the jury has to necessarily weigh all of that evidence. They're going to hear about the nature of the crime, how aggravated or ordinary a murder it was. They're going to hear about all sorts of stuff. And then they're going to be told, you have to decide whether a sentence of life with the possibility of parole is appropriate for this defendant, and the defendant has the burden to persuade you of that. And so I think we already have the jurors weighing all of the evidence. What this bill does is it simply clarifies that some of the evidence that can come in is evidence that, as the statute defines it, is simply victim impact evidence relating to the personal characteristics of the victim or the impact of the crime on the victim's family. And so I'm not sure that it necessarily requires any change in the jury instructions. It's just another piece of evidence to be weighed in the balance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? You've been very patient, Mr. Dole. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you for allowing me to speak. I was not originally signed up for it, so thank you for your courtesy. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'll make my comments brief. When I was listening to Mr. Wolf, I wasn't sure if I was traveling down the yellow brick road or if I was listening to Ghosts of Christmas Past. Crime victims have been fighting in this state for the last 25 years for certain rights. And the arguments that he made on victims' impact statements were a global attack on all victims' impact statements. They were absurd and they were insulting to victims who have taken the greatest hit that you can take as a human being, I promise you. The voters of this state have voted not once but three times, once statutorily and twice constitutionally, to place these rights in law. This is part of the Constitution, members of the committee, and the Constitution states that in all criminal proceedings and juvenile adjudications, victims have the right to speak. And again, it would be absurd to carve out one criminal instance where they don't have the right. And again, it is a right. We're not talking about statutory law anymore. Aggravating circumstances are allowed in when there is a death penalty case. Now, I haven't been in as many death penalty cases as the defense attorneys or the prosecutors here, but I've been to my share, unfortunately, and sat with victims, particularly during the sentencing, the penalty phase. There are cases where you could have a situation where the defendant has killed someone in their own family. And that could be offered as a mitigating circumstance. So I would ask you to just think about a couple of these issues when looking at this law. I might also say this, that I was at the Melissa Bittler trial, and the parents did testify. And believe me, it might have not been brought into the courtroom, but everybody and their brother knew that those parents were against the death penalty. All you had to do is read the Oregonian. Anyway, thank you very much for your time and your courtesy.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2227. Give that one a little more thought. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2312. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2312A would extend the time by which a motion requesting performance of DNA testing can be filed. Back in 2001, the Oregon State Legislature passed a law providing that individuals who had been convicted after trial of certain enumerated crimes could file a motion requesting performance of DNA testing on specific evidence. That law in 2001 included a sunset provision that would have gone into effect this year, and so that sunset provision was extended by the House Judiciary Committee for another 4 years. I do want to apologize to the committee. There was an amendment dropped off today, and so that was not included in my staff measure summary. That amendment is the -A3 amendment on this House bill. What the amendment would do is allow anybody convicted of certain enumerated crimes to request that DNA testing. So the reason that that's significant is that it would include persons who had pled guilty or no contest to the crime, in addition to persons who had gone to trial and been convicted, which was what the initial statute provided. Additionally, it would eliminate the sunset provision altogether.
Thank you. We have signed up Andrew Meyer and Kelly Skye.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
Could Council tell us who requested the A3 amendment?
I think we're looking at him.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I just want to clarify, Council, my understanding of our -3s is that it would actually intends only to have a sunset for 24 months. It's the sunset provision is odd in this bill because it's on the front page, but this is intended to be a two-year, not removing the sunset. The ACLU...
Wait.
I see. I'm sorry. I do see that on page 1, line 15. It would just... it would extend the sunset by 24 months. Thank you for that correction.
And I'll explain our thinking behind that. The ACLU of Oregon urges this committee to pass House Bill 2312 with the A3 amendments to make it truly accomplish its intended purpose. Known as the post-conviction motion for DNA testing, this law was passed 4 years ago with the support of the ACLU, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. There was no opposition. As the ACLU testified during the interim on some requirements in this law to the Judiciary Committee, DNA technology has been rapidly improving in recent years. That means that we don't need to, excuse me, that means that we need to develop a scheme that takes into account the technology we don't know will exist in 10, 15, or 20 years, let alone in a few years. DNA innocence testing is now used for those who previously had access to DNA testing. Last August, Wilton Dedge was exonerated after serving 22 years of life sentence for rape in Florida. With the help of the Innocence Project, he started fighting for DNA testing 10 years ago over a hair sample because the rape kit swab originally could not be used for DNA testing. The DA stated that the fact that the hair sample didn't belong to the convicted defendant was inconclusive, so he could not prove his innocence back then. However, with recent developments, technicians were able to conduct conclusive testing on the sperm cell fragment from the rape kit. Mr. Dedge was exonerated and released. 22 years of incarceration by an innocent man. We must ensure that this does not continue to happen in our society. But as long as we run the risk, we must ensure that a process that works to access justice is fully in place. The current law is limited to those who were found guilty after a trial when the identity of the perpetrator was at issue. It excludes anyone who pled guilty to a crime unless documented mental retardation existed prior to the crime. We urge this committee to expand the law to include those who pled guilty. The exclusion of those who pled guilty was a compromise 4 years ago. The major concern by law enforcement about this inclusion was about the numbers and related costs of this new law. At the time, we did not know how many people would request DNA testing, and the district attorneys were convinced that the law would be overused and potentially abused. But that didn't happen. And the law can only be used in such limited circumstances and requires review by a court before testing can even happen that there are plenty of safeguards to prevent abuse. As I said, no one, in fact, has used this law in the last 4 years. While that may be an indication that no one innocent is being incarcerated, it may also be because the current law is so limited, and as a general matter, there are also very few scenarios where the use of DNA can assist to exonerate someone. In other words, for someone to prove his or her innocence with DNA now, it must be undisputed, and I'm talking about DNA innocence after conviction, it must be undisputed that the DNA sample could only have been left by the perpetrator and it doesn't belong to the defendant. It's the only way in terms of establishing exoneration, because it's switched. The defendant has to prove his innocence in that case after they've been convicted. House Bill 2312 in its current form is so limited that it almost is meaningless. Let there be no mistake. We support a DNA innocence law, but it should, with the appropriate safeguards that already exist in the law, allow for meaningful access. We believe the -A3 amendments are necessary to truly implement the spirit of the law. We believe that even if someone pled guilty to a crime, we should not hesitate to apply the advances of DNA technology. If that person asserts their innocence, there is DNA evidence available. It would exonerate the person, and it's not already been tested under current technology. 4 years ago, the district attorneys argued the passage of this law would open up the door to abuse an impossible number of requests, so we put a sunset in the law to review it. We are now back 4 years later, and the result is that despite the concerns of the DAs, no one has used the law. By that, I mean no one has even sought access to it on the front end, let alone triggered its full process. This has not been a vehicle for abuse, and part of the reason why is how the law is structured to set up safeguards on the front end. Now the DAs argue that by expanding this law, it will lead to abuse again. Despite the fact that this concern turned out to be unfounded 4 years ago, we are happy to include a sunset provision to allow review of this law in 2 years' time. Second, the DAs have argued that this law can reopen the matter for a crime victim who sought closure. This argument does not follow a logical conclusion. There wouldn't be any basis to reopen a case unless there was meritorious evidence of the innocence of the defendant and DNA of evidence available to prove the innocence that hasn't been tested, to which technology now would allow testing. And then no one is served, neither the public nor the victim, if indeed an innocent person is incarcerated. No victim wants a false sense of closure when the guilty person is still free. The DAs have also suggested that there will be substantial cost to law enforcement if this law were broadened because of the indefinite retention and maintenance of evidence. There is nothing in this law that requires retention of evidence, and our amendments do not make any change to the status quo. Finally, the DAs argued that if you pled guilty, you must be guilty, and therefore we shouldn't establish a policy that allows someone access to DNA exoneration if they plead guilty. In all cases, we would hope this would be the case, and if so, even with the expansion of this law, no one will be making application under the DNA innocence law. Sadly, the premise that innocent people do not plead guilty isn't true, and it's not true in Oregon. In 1995, after serving 4 years in prison for murder, Laverne Pavlinik and John Sosnovic were exonerated for the killing of Tawana Bennett after Keith Hunter Jesperson pleaded guilty to the crime. After the victim's body was found, Laverne Pavlinik told police that her boyfriend, John Sosnovic, forced her to help him kill the victim and conceal the crime. She learned details from the case from the news accounts and later even produced a cutout section of denim that seemed to match one missing from the fly of the victim's pants. She also led investigators to the approximate area of the dump site. The story was convincing enough to convict Ms. Pavlinik. Although she recanted at trial, explaining she had lied in an attempt to escape her abusive relationship with her boyfriend, the jury did not believe her. In light of that, Mr. Sosnovic pleaded no contest to murder for a life sentence in order to avoid the death penalty. Only because the real killer admitted to the crime and was able to lead police to the evidence were the innocent exonerated in this case. On May 22nd of 2005, just recently, the New York Times reported that a man charged with murdering a 10-year-old after falsely confessing was released. Fortunately, good police work and the use of DNA incontrovertibly established another person committed the murder. But we will never know why he confessed to the crime he did not commit. Innocent people do plead guilty, and when we're speaking of life and death matters, of imprisoning someone for most, if not all, of their life, we should not be afraid of offering DNA testing if it will exonerate even one innocent person. We urge this committee to expand the bill to include this one segment currently excluded. Like the rest of those eligible for this law, it may never be used. But we hope, if there's ever any case where an innocent person is incarcerated in Oregon, and there is, by happenstance, biological evidence available to be tested, and in those rare situations where the result would exonerate the individual, that we provide the avenue upon which that person may, be they someone who pled guilty or is found guilty by a jury, to seek justice. We should not be afraid to have our justice system withstand that kind of scrutiny. Indeed, I cannot imagine a DA anywhere in our state ever wanting to know that an innocent person sits in jail. The ACLU urges this committee to amend this law with the -A3 amendments and support its passage. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. Ms. Skye.
Good afternoon. Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we too support
House Bill 2312 and, in particular, the Dash 3 amendments. I think that Ms. Meyer very eloquently covered the reasons that we support this bill, and I just want to emphasize that the procedural protections that are provided in this bill are adequate to cover any of the concerns that could be raised by the state. Again, this only provides a vehicle for a motion requesting the performance of DNA testing. And with that motion, a convicted person must provide an affidavit that establishes a number of things, including a prima facie showing that there is DNA testing, and there is DNA evidence. They need to identify the specific evidence to be tested and the theory of defense that testing would support. And before the court can order the testing, the court must find that there is a protective chain of custody that can be established, but the court must find that there is a reasonable possibility that the testing will produce exculpatory evidence that would establish the innocence of the person. The courts can be the safeguard that we need, and there's no reason to believe that we are expanding this law to the point that it will be abused. The safeguard is there, the procedural protections are there, and this bill is necessary to be on the books for the possible one case that may come through the system, but it's not broad enough to allow the abuse that some may be wary of. So OCDLA urges you to pass this bill. It's an important piece of legislation for Oregon to have in its statutes.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Our reduced committee here. Okay, Mr. Bradley.
We go through this very. Since he has the Dash 3 amendments and I don't.
The more the you haven't seen. Okay, my apologies. Welcome.
I was afraid he was going to make me start. For the record, I'm Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I, too, chair the ODAA Legislative Committee. My apologies in part, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. We weren't aware of these amendments until committee counsel actually advised me of them about 1:05 today. So when I've not had an opportunity to look at them closely, although I've been trying to go through them while we were sitting here, and have some comments. When the first DNA post-conviction relief DNA bill was passed, it was, as mentioned, was brokered through all the parties to allow an opportunity for those who had gone through trial, and in fact, looking back to times when DNA may not have been explored by defense counsel, either because it was not sufficiently known or defense counsel didn't see it as important at the time, to allow an opportunity for individuals who actually went to trial and were convicted to have that evidence reviewed with now new DNA technology. In part, the original sunset, as I understand it, and I was not involved with the original passing of this legislation, but the original sunset was established to say, all right, we're going to give you this period of time to say, one, if you're innocent, and there has to be a filing saying from the defendant saying he's innocent, and that the DNA would find them, would be exculpatory, and in fact establish innocence, it would allow them an opportunity of time which may be beyond appeals, beyond what may have been original post-conviction relief dealing with other issues, and a chance for that to be heard. We agree with that in light of the fact that, in fact, DNA has come a long ways. But now we find ourselves years down the road with the sunset rapidly approaching, and the ACLU and criminal defense bar now wants to open the door even wider, not to just those who said they weren't guilty to begin with, but now to anybody, including those who pled guilty or no contest. In other words, they're asking us to go back to victims of crime and say, well, you know, the defendant pled guilty. He stood up in court and swore he was guilty of this offense. And now he's saying, well, gee, I wasn't really, and I want to have DNA testing to prove otherwise. Victims, as you heard much more eloquently than I'm putting it, have a right to closure, and I would, with all due respect, disagree with the ACLU's position that, in fact, victims ought not to be opposed to this. In fact, they are. Victims are concerned that these cases are going to come up over and over again.
Well, wait a second. Are you saying that it's more important for a victim to have closure than to have someone who's innocent, who may have pleaded guilty for whatever reason and is not guilty, that the victim's need for closure justifies keeping an innocent person imprisoned?
Chair Burdick, absolutely not. What I'm saying is that I would disagree that we have, I'm not saying it will never happen, but situations where DNA exists, where in fact those would enter a plea of guilty. You have to remember that this says DNA will exonerate the defendant. We've now been in a situation where criminal law has been dealing with DNA evidence in this state for some 10 to 15 years. And DNA has been a part of the criminal justice system. We allowed the door to open for those who were found guilty. We now have people who have pled guilty, who said it's there. And it is, candidly, Chair Burdick, I think it's unreasonable to expect that those who have pled guilty would not have attacked it in some other fashion previously. I don't believe that we have those. Have I had cases in my court where, in fact, people have been convicted and come back later with additional evidence? Yes, we have, but never DNA evidence. DNA evidence in the bill as it is so detailed and so exacting that, in fact, it either excludes the defendant up front or it does not. It either excludes them or includes them, typically.
Then what would be the harm in just if there's just one case that slipped through the cracks, what would be the harm since the existing system isn't used? It hasn't been used.
Chair Burdick, what this bill will do is say, okay, all of you out there, everybody in the institutions who have pled guilty, this is your chance to, you think there might be DNA evidence out there, which in fact there usually isn't. In fact, I should say as an aside, the only petition in my court on this was from someone who was tried and convicted, but no DNA evidence existed. They didn't even argue that it would be exonerating if it was or point to it. And, in fact, we still had to prepare responsive briefs and defend it for the frivolous action. That's what I think this opens the door to. It says, come on, bring on these challenges, and we'll run post-conviction relief for DNA on all these cases where people not only are guilty but have pled guilty. That's the problem. I would also say, Chair Burdick, that in reality, and I can't speak for 100% of my colleagues of elected DAs, but I can't imagine one of them who, if defense counsel came and said, look, you've got DNA over in the evidence locker at the sheriff's office that my guy now is telling me that he thinks would be exonerating, we'd go out and test it. We don't need to have this invitation. We would go out and test it. And in fact, it's been my understanding that the Attorney General's office, when they have had post-conviction relief cases that have not directly raised these issues, when it comes up, they just go out and test it. None of us, you're absolutely right, none of us want to see someone who's innocent of a crime in jail or in prison. That's not what we do. We seek to achieve justice, not just have people put in jail. This, though, Senator Burdick, I think would actually be an open invitation and actually asking them to come and do this, and I think would be a huge expense for our offices. And
I'm asking this straightforwardly.
I understand.
There's a difference between going through the process and making an application. Have you had a lot of applications under the existing system?
It's my understanding statewide there have been very few applications.
So it's hard for me to understand why there would be a lot more applications just because someone had pleaded guilty.
Senator Burdick and members of the committee, you have so many more offenders who entered pleas of guilty and are incarcerated than those who go to trial. We have probably somewhere between 5 and 7% of cases in this state that actually go to trial. Mm-hmm. Most offenders stand up, reach a negotiated plea with the state, enter a plea of guilty, and are held accountable for their offenses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even without this bill, if a person went out and found their DNA evidence and it proved them innocent and they had pled guilty, couldn't the governor then commute their sentence?
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, the first answer is yes, the governor could. However, I would respectfully suggest it would never get that far. The district attorney's office would find some stipulated mechanism to bring them back before the court and have the plea of guilty or the conviction overturned.
So I guess just so if there is a case out there and they did find the DNA evidence to prove they were innocent, there is a mechanism already without this amendment to get that person out of jail.
Chair Burdick,
like a couple of
and Senator Byrd, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Are you done? We kind of interrupted you. Are you done?
No, that's fine. And again, I was kind of shotgunning, making notes to myself as I was not aware this would be up today and in the context in which it is.
The glories of mid-June,
yes.
Early June. Mr. Bradley.
I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I just want to add a few things to what Mr. Berry said. Nobody takes lightly the fact that somebody may have been, you know, convicted and were innocent. In fact, is the very case that you heard of, the Pavlenak case, came out of Multnomah County, where these two people were convicted. One, I believe, of manslaughter. The other pled, I believe, no contest to murder. They were both given lengthy sentences. The evidence appeared to be fairly overwhelming against both. And then Mr. Jefferson, I'm not saying that right.
Jesperson.
admitted it. And I was one of the five people in our office that spent about, seems like forever, you know, going through and making sure, you know, that what he said was correct. And at the end of the day, our conclusion was that we may have, you know, convicted two innocent people. And based upon that, we found a mechanism to get the convictions reversed. Because I agree with Mr. Berry says, there's nobody who wants to convict innocent people. We simply don't want to do that. I think with this bill, if there's a problem out there, I'm suggesting to the committee, you pass it as is, in 2 years or 4 years, we look at it again and see if there's been any case, if there's been one case in the state of Oregon that's come up where somebody who pled guilty wanted a DNA test and couldn't get it. The problem is this. It is. There's several costs. Now, it's true. The costs are minimized because the defense has to make a prima facie, you know, showing of innocence. What that means in some courts will mean one thing, and what it means in other courts will mean others. But most of these things that this will apply to are sex offenses. I mean, let's face it. I mean, I'm not saying it can't apply to anything else, but most of these are going to apply to sex offenses. And I've been a prosecutor for a lot longer than Mr. Berry, actually, and I can tell you this. It is the one crime that defendants don't want on their record. It's the one crime they don't want to admit to. I mean, I can get someone to admit to a murder rather than a sex crime, and yet this is the very crimes that we're going to be going after. When we talk about closure, no victim wants an innocent person convicted. But victims do want the case over or have some belief that the case is going to be over. This simply doesn't do it. First of all, most sex offenders don't plead guilty. Most of them plead no contest as a practical matter. Anyway, in our county, I don't know what Mr. Barron...
And this would cover the no contest.
This would plead. This would cover.
Well.
But the other thing is this: the cost of maintaining the evidence is just an administrative nightmare. I mean, the Portland Police Bureau right now, their evidence is just filling up buildings. And this would say that we probably, for some of these crimes, would have to keep the evidence forever.
But that's not in the bill, as I understand it.
No, but the problem is this, is the state cannot destroy exculpatory evidence. And if they do, what happens is the ramifications. Now, I'm aware of several cases where, you know, the state destroyed some evidence. In one case, there was a car, and there was the state got rid of the car because they didn't think of it. The defense said my brakes didn't work. Because the car was gone, they could no longer test the brakes. What the Court of Appeals ultimately concluded was they said in that case the state had to stipulate that the brakes didn't work. If somebody makes a prima facie showing and then you don't have the evidence, I assure you, you'll be in litigation as to whether or not the state destroyed exculpatory evidence. And it's, as I've said, it's just an administrative nightmare.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I just want to understand that better. Right now, the state is obligated to maintain exculpatory evidence?
No.
But you said Multnomah County has buildings full.
Well, they do, because what happens is this evidence goes into these buildings and nobody ever gets it out, and it just accumulates. And about every 5 years, we get a call from the Portland Police Bureau saying, help us, because things are just, you know, they don't have any more room to hold evidence.
And then you get rid of
And then what happens is they get rid of a lot of evidence, and we just cross our fingers hoping that we're not going to throw away some evidence that someday will come back to haunt us.
Madam Chair?
Is it Senator Ringo?
But, I mean, in this case, though, we're talking about hair samples, blood samples, maybe just some piece of skin. I mean, you're not talking about vehicles. You're talking.
Well, no, not. That's, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, you're talking about keeping all the evidence because you don't have a clue as to what evidence you're talking about. Is it an envelope? I mean, you get DNA off of envelopes. Is it this or is it clothing? Is it this and that? And, you know, you want to think that after a case, someone pleads guilty. And quite frankly, today, most any competent defense attorney would have done the DNA, and if they didn't, you do have a vehicle, and that's called post-conviction relief. But, again, my suggestion is, you know, I don't think this is a problem. In fact, is long before this law passed in Multnomah County, as part of our policy manual, we said that people could, you know, make application to our office on DNA, and it's just simply not happened. In fact, to my knowledge, since we've had that policy probably in place for 6 or 7 years, not one person has come forward because we said we'll try to get it tested for you as long as you make a showing. But it's the keeping of that evidence, and also it's important that victims have a sense of closure. I mean, to tell a rape victim, you know, look, this is probably over, but, you know, if he wants to later challenge it on DNA, he can do that. Again, it's a weighing process. You know, you don't want to convict innocent people, but you want victims to have some type of closure. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Chair Burdick, may I just mention one thing, and Senator Ringo and yours. I just got done with a two-week trial, which was a kidnap, multiple rape, multiple sodomies, and the like. And, in fact, we just released the automobile on that case, where, in fact, pieces of seats had been taken out, seat belts had been taken out, other things had been taken that the crime lab originally processed and seized, but we held the vehicle through the trial. And, in fact, I could see that if they were to, DNA was an issue in that case, in fact, matched the defendant. But let's say that there had been no DNA recovered from the vehicle. Then how long would we have to hold that vehicle, not knowing did we miss a hair, did we miss a spot of blood or some other fluid in the vehicle that then could have been challenged later. So although, candidly, it would be rare, it in fact can occur.
The way I read this bill is, you know, if you got rid of the evidence, then, I mean, the burden is on the, basically, the convicted person. It's a reversal of the burden. So if there's no DNA available, then they can't use it.
Well, except, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you note what the current law requires, and this one requires the same but opens the door wider, it requires the defendant to file documents in an affidavit saying, I'm innocent, there is DNA evidence out there that would be exculpatory to me and prove my innocence. Now, if the evidence through appeals, then the original post-conviction relief, everything's been over for a period of time and has now been disposed of, the defendant now says there was evidence there that would have been exculpatory to me, and now it's gone.
They don't have any.
Well, then the argument, that's the point I think Mr. Bradley was making, they would then make the argument, if you had retained that sheet rather than disposed of it, it would have had exculpatory evidence.
But the effect is nothing, because there's nothing in here saying that if evidence has been disposed of, then the person's conviction is reversed. That just isn't there.
Madam Chair, it's just part of, you know, the constitutional protection. You know, I'm sorry, I have not read the 83 amendments because I didn't have them.
And we're not doing anything with the bill, so we'll have time to look.
But the point is that there's no obligation, there's no statute that says, or maybe there is, but generally the state has to retain evidence. But where the state doesn't retain evidence and it, you know, exculpatory or in some cases potentially exculpatory, I may be going out on a limb here because I'm, you know, just this is coming off the top of my head, is there may be a constitutional requirement. It's like the Brady. You know, you can't hold back exculpatory evidence. Now, before Brady became Brady, there was no, you know, specific laws in Oregon saying that discovery had to be done. And then Brady came along and said it has to be done. So it's the Constitution that, you know, that dictates the requirement.
But the Constitution determined the conviction the first, and these are people who were found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, either by pleading guilty or by actually being found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
But, Madam Chair, even if you put something in this statute, and I'm certain the ACLU would actually agree with me on this, that said, if the state gets rid of the evidence, that's okay. I'm sure that they would come and say, you probably can't do that, just like I'm saying that. I don't think such a statute would stand because of the requirement of the Constitution.
Well, but you could put in a window for people to take advantage of this. I mean, because like you say, and
Madam Chair,
extend the window.
I mean, Mr. Barry, is that right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you tried this case where you just got rid of the car. You're pretty sure that's not there was not exculpatory evidence in the car, or you wouldn't have got rid of it, right? That's correct.
So you got rid of some evidence, and you were
comfortable with doing that, and there's no constitutional issue with that because it didn't have exculpatory evidence.
Chair Burdick and Senator Ringo, in that particular case, DNA was tried and matched the defendant.
Okay, but I guess anything's possible when you don't know what was in that car in terms of potentially exculpatory evidence that you were willing to get rid of it, and that defendant isn't going to be able to raise, well, you got rid of some evidence.
In that case, the defendant was not arguing it wasn't him. He was arguing I didn't do all the things you charged me with.
Uh-huh,
so it was not an identity case.
Madam Chair, Senator Zingo.
But I guess get rid of evidence all the time. Every now and then you go through and you clean out the building.
Well, at some point you want it. At some point you want to process the thing and move on, just like victims want to move on. But you know, in a trial, when you know you're going to get ready for trial, defense attorneys generally, you know, they'll want everything tested. They'll want to see everything. And generally, even on guilty pleas, on serious cases, defense attorneys want to see anything. But all of a sudden, you get a new attorney, and the defendant says something that they didn't tell their other attorney, and then things that were seemingly unimportant become very important. Okay. And it's tough to guess that. And in Multnomah County, anyway, I assume it's true of most counties, for serious cases, we hold on to the evidence for some period of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We're going to close the hearing on this bill, 23-112, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2969. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2969 modifies ORS 161610, which provides mandatory minimum sentences for persons convicted of using or threatening to use a firearm during the commission of a felony. This is a special finding that the trier of fact must make in order for this to apply. Subsection 4A of the statute allows for what I guess I would call an escape clause. The court has the discretion under subsection 5 to give that first-time offender something less than the 60 months that is required. It has recently come up in an issue that in a couple of cases that there's an ambiguity when a person is in on that second time of having used or threatened to use a firearm. Normally they would get that 120-month sentence, but there has been an ambiguity. I'll let Mr. Bradley give you a little background on the cases. But this bill would clarify that second-time offender, whether they had the 60 months or something less than the 60 months that first time, when they came back the second time, they would be subject to that second-time enhancement.
Mr. Bradley, you're back.
Did everybody understand?
I think you did. I actually did.
John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Let me try to explain it in layman's terms. With the gun minimum, 161610, when somebody is found guilty the first time of a gun minimum, Let's set Measure 11 aside, because with Measure 11, some of these things don't make any sense. But assume it's like a robbery with a gun. Before Measure 11, the judge could impose a sentence of, say, when we had indeterminate sentences, could have, you know, said, I'm going to give you a 20-year sentence with a 5-year mandatory minimum gun sentence. The person still was eligible for good time, but it was a 5-year sentence, and they had to serve, you know, some of that 5-year period. when this was enacted by the legislature, the legislature put in something that was sort of an escape valve because they thought maybe once in a while you had somebody who came in using a gun, but you really didn't want to give them the gun minimum. So they put in subsection 5, which is on the second page, where it says if it's the first time the defendant is subject to punishment under this section, it said that the court could do anything less than 5 years, including give a probationary sentence. That was actually to be the exception to the rule. Now, I cannot speak for other counties, but what happened in Multnomah County is that exception sort of became the rule. I want to say 7 or 8 years ago, we looked in to see how many, you know, gun cases, how often were judges imposing the gun minimum. And we found, I believe at the time, it was less than 50% of the cases gun minimums were being imposed. Now, so does that make sense in what a judge can do with a gun minimum? First time. In other words, the judge can decide a 5-year minimum or give the person probation. Now, the second time the person comes in the gun minimum, the legislature, when they passed the law, said, well, if it's your second time, you get a 10-year minimum. In other words, more than the first. Now, does that make sense? My second time, 10 years?
To everyone but me, Mr. Bradley.
All right. Well, the trouble is this. There's an ambiguity in the law in which the judges, and I think everybody else, cannot agree on what it means. If a person comes in the first time and they get a probationary sentence on the gun minimum, and then they come in the second time, is that really their first time or is it their second time for purposes of sentencing? In other words, did they get a 5-year sentence or did they get a 10-year sentence? We have taken the position in our office that it's a 10-year sentence.
Yes.
And the judges, you know, the judges are split on whether or not it's a 10-year sentence or a 5-year sentence. And we just think the legislature ought to say, you know, on the second time you commit a felony with a gun, that it ought to be 10 years. And I think that's what you know, when you first passed this, I think this is what you were trying to say. And just because the ambiguity in the law, and this would fix that ambiguity. It's just a housekeeping thing. And if you don't think that should happen, then you should say it's the second time, and the first time you got probation, then it's a 5-year sentence. But at least, you know, it's just not crystal clear. Now, is that clear?
Yep, it actually
is. Very clear.
Very clear. And it was also clear when counsel said it.
I know.
Okay.
Well, you really confused me. I understood it when
Thank you, Senator.
Are there any questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on 2969, and I'd like to open a work session once people have heartburn over this. Senator Starr?
I would move House Bill 2969 before a Food Pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2969 to the Senate floor with a Due Pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry this?
Yes, I would.
I'm glad about that. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2322. John Bradley Day, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2322 would expand assault in the first degree to include intentionally or knowingly causing serious physical injury to a child under 13 years of age. That is the Angross version. What we did on the House side is lowered the victim's age slightly by just 1 year, but we added as well a 5-year age difference between the actor and the victim so that the concern of OCDLA regarding sort of the schoolyard fights was addressed. Serious physical injury, just so you know, is defined by statute as physical injury which creates substantial risk of death or which causes serious and protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily organ. Assault in the first degree carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 90 months. There was a fiscal statement issued on this. The bill has no fiscal impact in the next two biennia. But based on what came up last week in one of our hearings, I did go ahead and have Mr. Penn include the fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Thank you. And we will have John Bradley and Brad Berry for a return appearance here.
Well,
getting all your bills done, John, so you won't have to come back again to this place, maybe not until sine die.
I love it.
Welcome again.
Go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I've graciously agreed to go first on this. I wish I was going to present this better than I'm going to present it, because it's such a, I think, such an important bill. And so when I lose you in a lot of confusion, you know, just stop me. The reason why we felt that this bill was so important was because what we see in Multnomah County, and I'm assuming it's seen throughout the state, is we have assaults on children, on young children who are unable to defend themselves, and as a result, they get some very, very serious injuries where the current punishment is simply inadequate. When you take a child that's, say, less than a year old, and someone comes up and shakes that child and causes incredible injuries. In fact, as I think the four examples that I've passed out to you, I think they're very graphic as far as some of the kinds of cases we see. The result has been is it's far worse than an assault in the second degree. Because what happens is this. You're talking about defenseless children. You're talking about injuries at a very formative time in their lives when their, you know, their brain is developing. And what we see is we see in some cases that development stops. We see, you know, children put into comas. We said, and yet it's an assault too, because we can't show under the current assault one statutes that a dangerous or deadly weapon was used. Now, as Mr. Sparks put in the memorandum that I've circulated to staff, he said that once in a while we can show that maybe a floor or a wall was involved. In such case, we can say it's been a dangerous weapon because, you know, it's the manner in which it's used, it becomes a dangerous weapon. But oftentimes what you have is you have a child who is in critical condition, and the effects on the child are long-lasting. In fact, in many cases, especially with these really young children, their life is changed forever just because of the severe damage that we see.
I just want to make sure I understood that. So if there's a dangerous weapon involved, then you don't have this problem.
No, if somebody...
I see.
If somebody hits the child against the wall, dangerous weapon means any article or substance in the manner in which it's used is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Well, if somebody smashes a child against the wall...
Or fists.
No.
I see.
That's something... I would argue that a fist, under those circumstances, is a dangerous weapon. But there, you know, the legislature has not addressed that, and the courts have not addressed it when it comes to a small children. They've said fists, when you're talking about, you know, comparable adults, are not dangerous weapons normally. But the, you know, the thing I was thinking as I was driving down here is I've got a little boy who's 5 1/2, and... here I am, an old man, but I weigh 4 times what that little boy, you know, weighs. I calculated that if somebody walked in that was 640 pounds and didn't have any fat on him, and he were to assault me, I would be at his mercy. I mean, he would tear me apart. And the same thing is true of little boys and little girls. And as I've said, I think if you read these examples of what we said, that's the reason why the law is important. I want to say about 7 years ago, and I think Senator Burdick remembers this, we came down and we revamped the aggravated murder and the murder by abuse statutes to, I believe, apply to children under 12 years of age. And we did it because we thought that children that old, you know, they were especially vulnerable, and therefore the murder laws... Again, I'm sorry I didn't bring my book. I think it's under 12. It may be under 14, but I think it's under... Is it 14? But when a child is under 12, they're particularly vulnerable. And this just... And they're developing. Their mind's developing. And their bodies are developing. And when they're assaulted at that age and you have serious physical injury, the result is something that lasts forever. And it's not like... At least with adults. Once you talk about adults and you get in a bar fight and two people are sort of equal, or, you know, the child can hold his head up. You know, that's a lot different than when you're talking about defenseless children. And I would ask to pass the measure as it passed in the House.
Appreciate that. And the house threshold is 12 years old?
13.
13 years old.
Under 13.
Under 13 years old.
And I can say there was not, you know, the sort of cutoff line from the house perspective was essentially puberty. I mean, just the idea that at some point a child is going to have some developmental stages where they're going to be stronger and better able to predict them, to protect themselves, and that was just the very general line we drew in the sand.
So basically, you wouldn't need any weapon. I mean, because if you shake a baby, you don't need him to hit anything to do the damage. You don't need to hit him or anything.
Right. It's just if you cause the serious physical injury. Mm-hmm. And serious physical injury, I might add, Madam Chair, it's generally a pretty, you know, high hurdle to get over. I always like the case of a guy who got shot and the bullet lodged in the middle of his head, and none of the doctors said it was life-threatening, and Court of Appeals said that's not serious physical injury. But, you know, I'm serious. But serious physical injury really does mean the risk of death or a lot of disfigurement.
We learned so much in Judiciary Committee. Mr. Berry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and also for the record, I will not tell you how much someone who weighs four times as much as I do would be coming in the door.
Me neither, Mr. Our secret is safe.
I don't have actually a lot to add to what Mr. Bradley said. This is an Oregon District Attorneys Association bill originally. I recall as it was originally before the House, the changes were made. It was originally to track with the aggravated murder, the 14. That's where the 14 years of age came. And we certainly didn't have a problem with the recommendations made from the House. And also didn't have much. We talked some about the age difference, but that too, that amendment, we certainly don't have the qualms. This is a child protection law and recognizes that small children, not just babies, but small children up, I would suggest to 4, 5, 6, and 7, really a large adult, typically a caretaker, is in a position to exact extreme injuries to these children just with their hands and with feet. One of the first cases I had after being elected in our office, in fact, dealt with a caretaker just beating the heck out of a small child. And as I recall, the child lost a kidney, had 6 or 7 broken ribs, all from being kicked barefoot, too, because we'll charge boots and shoes as a weapon to try and get past that hurdle, but this was barefoot and with his fists. And this is something that really is necessary to protect children from really egregious conduct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
I'm all for this bill, but I don't think it'll protect children because I don't think these perpetrators think 1 second about the penalties when they're doing this. Just a comment.
Makes the rest of us feel better sometimes to be able to punish him a little bit more severely. Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose House Bill 2322. And I would say at a policy level, we will oppose any expansion of Measure 11. But I think it's important that the committee keep in mind that this is an expansion of Measure 11. And it increases a mandatory minimum sentence for conduct not only that adults commit, but that juveniles commit, that 15, 16, 17-year-olds commit. And it is significant in a number of ways. One, we're not just changing one element of the crime of assault in the first degree. We're changing a couple. First of all, we're changing the mental state required to commit this crime. Currently, assault in the first degree requires intentionally causing serious physical injury. This lowers that mental state to knowingly, which is significantly different. It's significantly easier for a prosecutor to prove that someone knew of their conduct when they committed it than it is to prove that someone intended their conduct. So we are significantly lowering the mental state required to commit assault in the first degree and Measure 11 offense. We also are removing the element of deadly or dangerous weapon. And as you heard, just about anything can be a deadly or dangerous weapon. And And I've had the cases where the table that the person fell on was the alleged dangerous weapon, or the shoe or boot that the person was wearing when they kicked someone was the deadly or dangerous weapon. We've taken that requirement out. And so now you've lowered the mental state, you've reduced yet another of the elements, and you're applying, the thing to remember is that this applies to everyone. It doesn't just apply to adults and caretakers who abuse their dependents. And in the cases that are provided in the District Attorney's Association's memo are at the extreme end of what this bill will cover. And if the committee deems that it's appropriate to expand Measure 11 to cover the cases here, then what the committee should do is lower the age from 13 down to 3 or 4, because they don't cite cases where the child is older than 3 or 4. Their primary purpose, their stated purpose, is to get these shaken baby cases. We worked with counsel in the House we wanted the age requirements lowered even further than they are. We were, of course, happy to have this limited further than it was in its initial form. I think initially it was 14 years of age and there was no age requirement, 5-year age difference. But this bill will still cover a 15-year-old who punches a 10-year-old and knocks out their tooth. There's case law that says that with proper expert testimony, a jury can find that a broken tooth is serious physical injury, and I've had a case where that was charged. So a 15-year-old who punches a 10-year-old is now charged with the Measure 11 Assault 1. Under current law, they would be charged with the Measure 11 Assault 2, but what's significant is that under Assault 2, that juvenile, under ORS 137.712, is eligible for reduction in sentence. What was passed as Senate Bill 1049 a number of sessions ago gave an escape valve, and many people supported that bill, saying that escape valve on those level second-degree offenses was necessary, especially in the case of juveniles. And so you are taking these juveniles, 15, 16, 17-year-old, out of that escape valve, and you're putting them into a first-degree offense that has no escape valve. And that's significant. It can be a 15, 16, 17-year-old that is committing an offense against a 10, 11, 12-year-old. And while in many, if not most cases, serious physical injury is along the lines of what you've heard from the DA's Association, it also can be much less than what you've heard from the DA's Association. So I would ask you to think seriously about expanding Measure 11 in this respect to keep the mental state at intentionally and to lower the age below 13. Lower it to 4, 5, or 6, the age that their stated purpose is intended to cover. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2322. And we are out of time, so we are going to move. Committee, we are not meeting tomorrow because we are having the Budget Subcommittee on Public Safety has invited us to attend the briefing about the Oregon Youth Authority sex abuse charges, and that is tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and it should take the full 2 hours. And we will meet on Wednesday at our regular time and again in the evening, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. to begin our meth hearing on the two bills that the methamphetamine work group put together. So Wednesday is going to be a big day. Thursday, we may also have a long day. We will start at 1, and we're free to go as long as 5 o'clock because we will be continuing the methamphetamine hearing. So the bills that we will put to the regular meeting on Wednesday from 1 to 3 are House Bill 2282, House Bill 2297, and House Bill 2361. And watch your emails, because our schedule is going to be a little different next week. We're going to have a couple days where our committee will start at 3 o'clock instead of 1 o'clock. So it's that time of year, committee members. And Senator Starr, if you could tell Senator Witsit that, and I will tell Senator Walker, we should be covered. And Senator Brzezinski. Okay.
Chair, I will be learning in the next day or two when my surgery is to happen, and that's going to be next week, either 13th or the 15th. So I will be gone for at least a week.
Oh, okay. Well, we will. And the judiciary is adjourned.